Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Joe Swanberg.
Okay. It was very nice to see that on the big screen. I mean, one of the things that just struck me was actually how good looking it is. I mean, how carefully controlled the compositions are and the use of color. You know, you would think in sort of just filming in an apartment, it would just sort of be a mess, but...
yeah, it was the idea was to do super stripped down production design that did have really specific color palette.
Yeah.
This really, yellow, red, and blue, and this very poppy, candy colored kind of look to it. On with no money and no production. So like, you know, the few things that we did actually buy were like that bright red futon cover, that blue little table that sits in her, just a few key like production purchases that set the tone in that apartment, because I knew we'd be spending a lot of time in that apartment.
And you just tell us a bit about like what you were working with, like camera production. This was your third film, so you've gone from
So this was right at the time I'd shot the first two standard definition video. This was high definition video, which at the time I was using the Panasonic HVX200, which shot on P2 cards, and which I actually the camera that we shot Hannah Takes the Stairs on, Anish, my co-producer, and who then produced Nights and Weekends and Alexander the Last. We went ahead and bought the camera for Hannah Takes the Stairs so that we could keep doing movies with it, and I used that same camera for everything up through, I believe, art history in 2010. So for 4 years, I used the same camera. So it was a workhorse of a camera, and I cut on Final Cut Pro. As I said, I was sort of living in the apartment with everybody, and the laptop was just sort of out, and so. We would shoot a little bit every day, and then I would edit, and the actors would sort of be around while I was editing. I'd bring people in to watch scenes occasionally. You know, it was like this very... all of us were making the movie together, and then the sound was recorded by Kevin Buersdorf, who also did the music, and he and I were the only crew. I shot the movie, and he was sound, and so it was us and the actors.
So... you know, of course, one of the ironies in this film is that you've got this office where people are sitting around writing scripts, and we see like the traditional script format. We were talking before the screening, and you said you're doing a project now, and you said you're writing your first script, and that sort of threw me off because I knew that you had done a lot of improvisation. But is this literally true that you actually don't work with scripts? And could you talk about how this style evolved for you?
Yeah, no, it is true that I don't work with scripts. I've never written one. I'm writing the first one right now. not even for myself, I've never written one.
Making 16 films is a good way to get
exactly. Yeah. And also, as I sort of figured out how to do that, it became less and less necessary.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, why am I doing it now? And the answer is, I don't know. Other than it seemed like a challenge I should tackle at this moment.
Right.
But with Hannah Takes the Stairs, there was like a two-page... As I started to talk to Anish about it, I had done this movie called LOL that premiered at South by Southwest, and Anish saw it there. And we had coffee that week, and he said, what are you working on next? And I said, I sort of have this idea about... this woman who goes through these three different relationships over the course of a summer in Chicago. And so I wrote out a little two-page, prose thing kind of about the character and a couple scene ideas and things like that. And that was enough for Anish to say, okay, let's do the movie. And so I never wrote anything more than that, sort of knowing that the actors would come to town and we would just make it. And then having gone through that experience, then jumping into Nights and Weekends next, it was very easy to say to Anish, let's do it again for even less money. And then on Alexander the Last, it was the same thing. So we did those three movies in a row. Noah Baumbach produced Alexander the Last, and there were some bigger actors that were interested in starting to get involved. And so by that point, then for the next one, it was like, well, Joe doesn't work from school. It had sort of just become established that I wasn't going to write anything, and then nobody ever asked me again.
The film is very touching. And it's very, just feels so emotionally sort of true throughout. And it feels so much like it was built for these people. Obviously, you have Greta Gerwig, who's such an amazing personality, and is, you know, now becoming, as everybody knows, a big star with a network TV show. But could you talk about sort of finding the people and sort of, and building the structure of the film around the people?
Yeah, sure. So Greta was in LOL, which is the one that I did right before this, via cell phone pictures and voicemails and things like that. And one of my main collaborators on LOL was Chris Wells, who Greta was his girlfriend at the time. And so he was like, well, I have all these real cell phone pictures and real voicemails, and we can use these and then make some new ones specifically for the movie, and then it'll create this interesting mix of like documentary and narrative stuff. And Greta was excited to sort of participate in that project. And when the movie premiered at South by Southwest, she came down along with the sort of roving LOL gang of people that I worked with on that movie. And so I got to know her a little bit at that festival, and this conversation with Anish about doing something next made her feel like a really natural fit for this movie. And then Mark Duplass, I had met when my first film, Kissing on the Mouth, had played at South by Southwest. Same with Andrew Bujalski. And I forget where I met Todd Rohal. I met Rye along the way. But, you know, this sort of regional film festival circuit became, for me, who you know, I lived in Chicago at the time, and I still live in Chicago, and there's not, it's not like a hotbed of indie film production or anything like that. The festival circuit was a way for me to meet people, you know, potential collaborators. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I was just pulling in the people who were exciting to me, or who are also making interesting work, and who I thought were up for it. You know, it's kind of a lot to ask somebody to come to Chicago for 3 weeks and you know, stay with seven other people in a tiny apartment, and I wasn't going to be using them every day. You know, it's not like I had a schedule and I could say like, okay, cool, you have Tuesday off and we're shooting with you Wednesday. It's like, I didn't know what we were doing every day. So they kind of had to all just like sit around and wait for me to decide that I was going to shoot something with them. So, you know, looking back on it, I realize, you know, how generous they were being to just sort of be up for that production process to begin with. But we were all a lot younger then too. Like, I wouldn't do it now. You know, if a 24-year-old asked me to go to Carolina for a month and like sleep on the floor in an apartment, I'd be like, I'm sorry, I'm too old for that. So it was kind of this magical time where everyone was just up for it, and nobody was as busy as they are now.
Yeah. But how did the, you know, how did you decide what was going to happen next in the story? Because it's so, like, the film feels so attuned to what's like happening emotionally with Hannah, you know, just the pacing of when she starts to get disenchanted or when she starts to fall in love.
Yeah. Well, Greta's a writer. I mean, she's much more of a writer than I am. And so, we were talking every day about things like that. And other than Mark, who had a very short window, I think Mark could only come to Chicago for 4 days. So we had to map his part of the relationship out. But with Andrew and Kent, there was a lot more access and time with them. So we could almost shoot chronologically and sort of build it as we were going. But I think that we were, you know, it was this kind of environment where the shooting of the movie and the just existing in the apartment were all wrapped up in each other. So there wasn't a very clear divide between what was a writing session where we were coming up with ideas for the movie and what was just all of us hanging out for fun. And so it all, you know, it was like having six or seven really smart people writing constantly. You know, it was like somebody would do something and then it would be like, oh, cool, that's a cool idea. for a thing, let's do that tomorrow. And then we would do that, and then that would sort of get plugged into the Final Cut Pro timeline. And then it was like, okay, great. So that feels like a nice moment. And this thing from 3 days ago worked pretty well. So like, but they can't go next to each other. So now what scene can bridge these two things? So is this sort of intuitive, like this sort of running Final Cut Pro timeline of a yeah. movie that was just like the gaps were getting filled in, things were getting moved around, and and a month seemed like a really long, luxurious amount of time to have to figure that out.
Yeah. How do you talk through use of nudity in the film? Because it's obviously at the beginning and end of the film. In sort of real life, it's casual. You know, it's just part of real life with couples. But in a movie, it always feels more heightened.
Yeah. Well, I wanted the movie to have a palindrome structure, and the name Hannah is a palindrome. And I was thinking about this movie that would end right where it began. In the shower, it ended up being in the shower, but just as I was, before it was even that specific, just as I was thinking about the movie, I wanted this feeling of this woman who goes through these relationships and this idea of chronic dissatisfaction, and that, sort of over the course of this summer, she lands right back where she started and has learned a few things, but, is kind of right back in a complicated relationship with a guy that probably isn't a great fit, and so that shower/bath thing sort of became a nice bookend structure to that. And then in the meantime, I think, it was that our main objective was realism, and it was such a comfortable, easy set that, the sort of breakup scene with Greta and Mark, where she, changes out of her bathing suit or whatever, wasn't scripted or structured. It was just what Greta felt was the right thing to do right then.
Yeah.
And there was never, it's one of the luxuries of making, a $50,000 movie with no famous people in it that none of us expected anybody would really ever see, was that we could follow our gut and sort of do the thing that always felt right without, like nowadays, there would be a big conversation about like, oh, I don't know, does that mean we get an NC-17 rating?
Right.
And like, we're spending too much money, we can't do that. So like, okay, maybe you should walk over there, but we shouldn't film it that way. It was just like every choice was being motivated by realism. And so it felt like shooting a documentary. I mean, the way that I was reacting to it as the camera operator was the way a documentary camera operator would, and we were oftentimes only doing things once. So there's a lot, you sort of see me reframing or zooming or kind of composing as it goes, the way you would a Verite documentary.
And I just want to ask you one thing, then we'll take some questions from the audience. But you did go to film school, and what I've read, I understand that you just sort of became disenchanted with the type of film you were being taught to make. So how you made that leap, to kissing on the mouth?
That's right. Yeah. I went to film school. I was taught 3-point lighting. I was taught composition, wide, medium, and close. All the sort of basic rules of filmmaking. But one of the things that was happening to me at film school was this inner sort of conversation I was having about why are all of these movies so bad, including my own? Like, what is it that we're doing wrong? And part of what I was figuring out is that the sort of Herculean effort of putting a crew together and getting locations and figuring out a schedule while also having a full class load, was kind of too much to tackle. And so by the time all of us got to set to make the movie, we were so exhausted that there was no real effort left to put into the movie itself. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things that I said coming out of film school was like, I'm going to make the process of getting to set so easy that all of my energy can be devoted into the actual creating of the thing that matters. Like, an audience doesn't care how hard it was to secure a location. An audience doesn't care that, like, you had a, hot shit sound guy who was known around your film school as doing the best sound.
Yeah.
And so all of these things that seemed important in the kind of environment of film school – Once I got out of there, I was like, oh, how do I make this easiest? Cast my friends. Don't like quit my job and have to do the movie over this like set production period. Like just shoot it on nights and weekends whenever everybody's free. Edit as you're going so that you always kind of have a running idea of whether things are working or not. You know, all these sort of things that were lessons from the bad stuff that I made and worked on in film school. And a big part of that for me too was like how to avoid mimicking other movies, which was seemed to me to be almost the fatal flaw of all the bad film school movies. It was like, here's the Quentin Tarantino trunk shot, and like here's the Goodfellas tracking shot through the kitchen, and here's the way, like this. So you know, at some point when it became mandatory for filmmakers to also be cinephiles with like an encyclopedic knowledge of film history, all these bad habits started creeping in of like, you know, films just being these like cultural reference points. And so I was like, how do I make something original? How do I even make something original having been a kid, like a high school student who worked in a video store and devoured four movies a day? Like, how do I even get my head out of a space where I'm subconsciously mimicking other movies I'd seen? And I thought, if I can put myself on a set where I don't know what's going to happen, then I can't frame up a shot the way, you know, Kubrick would have framed up the shot or something like that. So I think with a lot of these earlier films, it was the way they look is a very specific reaction to desperately trying not to have them look like anything else. And so, then that just kind of stuck.
Yeah, while you were saying that, I'm just thinking how many people are probably trying to make films like Joe Swanberg now.
I hope
like,
not.
That looks easy. Like I can do that.
Yeah.
But that's not your problem.
No, I guess not.
Okay, let's take some questions over here. I'll just repeat. Yeah, people can hear. Just as a man, why did you decide to make this movie from the perspective of the female character?
I think, I mean, most of my movies are about women. I think I went to school wanting to make narrative film. I went down to film school wanting to, I was really into Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino and Jim Jarmusch and, you know, the John Sayles, this like wave of American indie filmmakers. And I went down there wanting to make indie narrative films. And the film school that I went to, Southern Illinois University, the most famous graduate out of there was Steve James, who did Hoop Dreams. And the program was very focused on documentary and experimental film. And so, you know, I sort of showed up thinking like, cool, how do I make these hip American indie films? And then they were, you know, showing us Stan Brakhage and Herzog movies and stuff like that. And so it really was very disappointing my freshman year to realize that there was no emphasis on the industry or like teaching us how to be working narrative filmmakers. Everything was focused on like fucking up the system and like, the sort of bullshit sellout Hollywood thing. You know, I mean, it was really a lot to wrap my head around as a kid. But after 4 years of that, I came out with just a totally different sense of what film could be. And specifically, I was interested in documentary filmmaking and sort of thought that that's what I was going to do. And my first movie called Kissing on the Mouth really is a hybrid of documentary and narrative. There's a lot of real audio interviews spread throughout it, and the way that we shot it was very much modeled after a documentary film. And as a documentarian or as a sort of journalist with that approach to it, the subject matter, I mean, I feel like I know what it's like to be a man. I don't know what it's like to be a woman. And so that's always been the subject matter that's been interesting to me because I can learn something. And as a filmmaker, that's sort of always been part of what seems like the point of making a movie is that I could spend several months focused on a subject and come out the other end knowing more about it than I went into it. And specifically people. And so I think Hannah Takes the Stairs was really the start of that in a bigger, more narrative way. My first two movies were like post-film school grapplings with like trying to rebel against my parents, my professors, you know, like in this idea of like trying to incorporate all this documentary and experimental technique that I'd learned at school. And then Hannah Takes the Stairs was the first one where I was like, you know what, I'm just going to make a narrative film. There's not going to be experimental sequences. There's not going to be documentary sequences. I'm going to make a movie with actors about fake characters. But that sort of documentary approach and aesthetic was still there. And also that documentary interest as a filmmaker in picking a subject and then exploring that subject.
I should add, this film is very much about the men. I mean, it's about that, like, just how helpless they are, you know, in terms of falling in love, not being able to control it.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So when you didn't have a script and you were letting the actors make up the lines, did you give them direction as to, you know, I don't want you to just be yourself, I want you to be this kind of person?
So just a question of how you work with the actors, considering that you didn't have a script, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes. It was always an interesting question I had to ask myself of whether my direction was going to throw them off of something that they were doing that was interesting to me. Like, how much could I direct these, beginning or non-actors? Because a lot of them were directors who hadn't acted before. And so, sort of still the question that I'm always asking myself, even when I'm working with veteran actors who've been in a million productions, is like, what are they naturally doing that I'm responding to? And then how much am I going to mess with that if I ask them to change or if I'm sort of trying to give them a specific thing? So my approach that I remember with Hannah Takes the Stairs was if it wasn't working or if I sort of wasn't liking what was happening, rather than to try and coach them away from that or to try and give them specific character notes, it was just to rearrange the scene altogether. So if we were shooting something in the kitchen and it felt wrong or something felt off about it, I didn't want to do 10 takes and try and get them to a place. I was just like, oh, you know what? Let's go on the back porch and do this. Let's just totally change up the scenery. I thought the scene was going to be about this, but let's make it about this instead. And then like sort of using that so that I wasn't discouraging their performance or freaking them out, because as having acted myself as a non-actor, it's incredible to me how quickly I became full of insecurity and just desperately wanted to please the director, even if the director was a good friend of mine who normally the power dynamic's very equal. It's like as soon as there's a camera present and it's that person's movie and I'm just an actor in that movie, there's a strong desire to not fuck up, and it's not nice, you know. It doesn't feel nice as a performer. So I'm always, as a director, trying to be conscious of that and make sure that nobody on set feels like they're doing a bad job, even if they are occasionally doing a bad job. Just rearranging the setting and taking the blame for it myself, and feeling like, okay, I screwed up. This shouldn't be in the kitchen. Like I should have known, like, scene should take place outside and it should be about this. And then we just go do it again, and often that's gets us there.
And you also, the actors often have like very specific physical things to work with, like the ice cubes, that scene, or the goggles, or the trumpets, you know. So
yeah,
it's interesting how much
I wanted a lot of stuff around. I asked them to bring things like that. And also I did a little pre-shoot test run with Greta and Kent where they came to Chicago for a weekend just to shoot a little short film, and we discovered that they both sort of played the trumpet.
Yeah.
So then I had them, you know, I asked them to bring their trumpets, and you know, I wanted the house full of these objects that we could play with and that could sort of spark ideas. And also these in the scene with Kent and Greta where she's crying and he undoes her shoes and stuff, there's these little mechanical birds sitting on the window, you know, just these sort of toys in this sense of playfulness that to me went along with this like candy colored kind of poppy feeling.
Okay, we'll just take one or two more and then take a break before the next film. Go ahead. Who came up with the title?
I did, and it came from like the way that I, because I don't write scripts, the sort of the way that I started to wrap my head around this movie was like a drawing that I was sort of doing on a piece of paper to map out the timelines. And the way that I was sort of doing that ended up looking like stair step. I was sort of like mapping the movie along these different things. And this idea of Hannah takes the stairs sort of came out of this image of like this character over the course of the movie, not looking like a straight line, looking like these sort of staggered relationship moments. The way I wanted to kind of portray it was that at the beginning of the movie, you see the end of a relationship. In the middle of the movie, you see the middle of a relationship. And at the end of the movie, you see the beginning of a relationship. And I was just sort of diagramming it that way.
Okay, I'll take one more. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, they continue to inspire me. I'm always after that kind of looseness and the competing dialogue and a lot of that stuff, definitely.
You know, the last time I was here asking a question of Jim Cohen, it was about Robert Altman, but yeah, I would love to see you do a Nashville.
Yeah, someday, yeah, me too. I would love to do one. Yeah, it's really... he had a lot of clout when he did Nashville and could get a lot, you know, sort of command a lot of time and money and big famous actors. So if I ever get to that point, I would certainly dive into a production like that.
He had sort of like artistic cachet, right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But also MASH was a huge hit. He made a lot of money for somebody. I still haven't done that. Believe me, I'll cash that in when I have the opportunity.
Okay. Well, we'll see how Happy Christmas goes.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and come back if you want in just about half an hour, Nights and Weekends with Greta Gerwig again, and you'll get to see Joe on screen. And definitely don't miss Silver Bullets tonight, which is just crazy horror, beautiful horror film. So we'll see you in a little bit.
Yeah,
thanks
thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.